Begin today with a personal story relating something that happened to me when I was a young man, a day that started out like any other day. I had no inkling when this day started that it would have the impact that it had subsequently in my life. I ended up with an experience that would forever change my life, what I call a threshold experience. I got up that morning, showered and dressed, had my breakfast, collected my stuff to get in my truck to head to art school that I was attending at the time. It usually took me about an hour to get to school in the morning because I had to drive into downtown Cincinnati in morning traffic, and to try to avoid as much of that traffic as possible, I drove mostly back roads as far as I could so that I could avoid all of that and save myself the aggravation. I was about not quite halfway to school when my little truck began acting funny. It was a compact-sized pickup truck, one of these small pickup trucks, just had a little four-cylinder engine in it, so it didn't have a lot of pep to begin with, but this was more than usual, a lack of pep. I was going up a slight incline in this remote area, and I had no power. It began to hesitate more and more. Pushing down on the accelerator made no difference. Soon I began to feel a vibration from the engine and throughout the whole truck, and then a complete loss of power followed by smoke coming out from underneath the hood, to which I simply had no other option but to coast off the side of the road. My truck was essentially dead. It wasn't running, and when it was making a lot of noise. My attempts to restart the truck were met with this clatter of metallic sounds. I knew that wasn't good. More steam and smoke out from underneath the hood, so I decided to leave it. And although I knew enough to do minor repairs, I wasn't a mechanic, but I thought I would take a look under the hood anyway to see if I could assess the damage. And all I could assess was that there was an engine there. I didn't know what I was looking for. That was the extent of my analysis. I couldn't really determine anything wrong. Everything seemed to be in the right place. All the wires and big parts were there. I had plenty of gas in the tank. I didn't see anything dangling or broken off laying on the side of the road behind me. So what was I going to do now? This was years before cell phones, so I had no way to call anybody. And as I said, it's sort of back roads. I wasn't expecting a lot of traffic to come by anytime soon. And about either direction from where I had broken down, it was about a 3-mile walk to the nearest gas station. So I'm stuck. Either someone would have to stop to help me, or I'd have to hoof it to the next gas station. At that point, I decided it was a good thing to ask God to send some help, perhaps somebody that could at least assess what the damage was or to help me in some other way. And while I stood there continuing to look at the engine, hoping it would come back to life, this man finally stopped. He asked me what was the matter. I explained briefly. He had me get in and try to start it. And as soon as I did, he hollered at me to stop. And I got out, and I came around the front of the truck, and he showed me what the problem was, and it became apparent to even me what it was. Part of one of the crankshafts was hanging out the bottom of the oil pan. I'd thrown a rod. That truck wasn't going anywhere. I was surprised I didn't see more oil on the ground, but anyway, he offered me a ride at that point. He knew it wasn't repairable on the spot. He offered me a ride to the nearest phone, and I accepted. And the only person I knew to call at that time of day that could help me would be my mom. I was simply a young man of 19 working my way through college, through art school, to set a course for my life. And that event was setting the stage from something that would change the rest of my life, this threshold experience. And that's what I'd like to talk with you today about. Discuss with you threshold experiences and challenge you to consider and to remember how much our life changes as a result of God's calling. So what's so important about threshold experiences? I'm a big believer in the fact that small choices are really the things that make up our lives. The big events can come and go and they can have impact, but more significantly are the small things that add up over the course of time. The small choices. Our whole life is a learning experience, full of learning experiences, and our threshold experiences, those experiences we go through, are to help mold us who we are, I'm convinced. So what is a threshold experience? Since I've made up the term, I'll define it for you. It is an event or a choice that irrevocably changes your life in a way that can be good or bad. It's as if stepping into another dimension or through another door. Sometimes a threshold experience is something big in our lives, but as I mentioned, more often than not, I'm convinced it's something just in an average day that we have to make a choice on. I'd like to read to you at this point the poem from Robert Frost, the great American poet. He wrote this in 1916, piece entitled The Road Not Taken. Many of you might remember that from high school or college English. It said, two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both, and be one traveler long as I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. They took the other just as fair and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as far as the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay and leaves no step had trodden black. Well, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere in ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all of the difference. Many people have written many doctoral theses on what he meant in that. It's an interesting point to ponder. The choice not made. God has made us free moral agents. He has us on a road, so to speak, and at each fork in our road in our life, we have choices to make, don't we? Choices that become irrevocable. Robert Frost's poem, I think, sums up that point nicely. I think it would fit most of us. We've made choices, every one of us. We've made choices that have changed us forever, both good and bad. I'd like to look at some examples from Scripture to sort of illustrate this point. In Genesis 3, we have the interesting story of Adam and Eve as they make a pivotal choice in their life. God had placed them in the garden. He had recreated the earth. He had created a beautiful garden for them to live in, provided for every need that they had. And the interesting part, one of the interesting parts of the story is we're not told how long he instructed them, but I'm convinced he did. He didn't just create them and turn Satan loose. That would be irresponsible. He taught them. But at some point, you have to let them choose. God lets us choose. And in chapter 3, we have the story of this choosing. Satan comes on the scene in verse 1 of chapter 3 and says he was more cunning than any beast of the field which the eternal God had made. And he said to the woman, has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree? He begins to plant doubt in her mind. She begins to consider other possibilities. And so the woman replies, sure, we can eat of every tree except for that one. And Satan says, well, he doesn't want you to eat that one because if you do, you'll become like him. You'll be a god. And so she looks at it, verse 6, and sees that it's good for food, it's pleasant to the eyes, desirable to make one wise. And she took the fruit and ate, and she gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. And the eyes of both of them were opened. They stepped across the threshold. They had made the decision, and the consequences were now to come. So, in verse 8, they hear God stirring in the garden, walking in the cool of day. They hide themselves. God calls to Adam and Eve, Adam specifically in verse 9, and says, where are you? Again, I'm convinced not because he didn't know where he was, but he wanted to see what Adam would say. And he says, I heard your voice in the garden. I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself. Verse 11, and God says, who told you this? Prior to this, they didn't have this knowledge. And the consequences that come then begin in verse 15. You're going to have enmity between specifically the serpent, but the creation in general. In verse 16 then, to the woman, you're going to have sorrow in your conception. Your desire will be to your husband. He will rule over you. To Adam in verse 17, because you've heeded the voice of your wife, cursed is the ground for your sake. You shall toil and eat of it all the days of your life, but thorns and thistles it will bring forth for you. It's going to be a struggle. Consequences of the choice. What an impact that decision of listening to Satan had for them and all of us. And it's easy that we can point the finger at them and say, well, they made such a horrible choice, but we've all made the same choice, haven't we? We've all made our own choice to listen to Satan somewhere along the line, because in many respects, we're no different than Adam and Eve. That decision, though, changed their life, didn't it? I've often wondered about the next hundreds of years of their life, you know, when you consider how old they lived to be, how much pain and suffering they saw out of that choice. They saw their children kill each other. They saw wrong behavior in marriage. They saw wrong actions in other areas of life. They saw all kinds of bad things come, and they saw some good things come. It was the tree of knowledge of good and evil. But the consequence of knowing they would never be back in the garden. How has the same decision that we made affected our lives? The choices that we've made, very similar to Adam and Eve. The word threshold is an interesting word. It's an old English word. It literally means a hold for the thresh. In the houses of centuries ago, they didn't have finished floors. That was for the wealthy. Most people had dirt floors. And so to keep it from getting muddy in the snowy seasons or the rainy times, they would put the leftover threshings on the floor. And of course, that gets tracked around, and to keep it all from being dragged back outside, they would put a hold at the door. So you have a threshold. Well, we don't think of the word in that respect now. Mostly it just means an entrance or a beginning point of something. And that's certainly what we can use in this context. How many choices have we made in our life that we can look back on and say that decision or that event or that choice changed the course of my life? Again, I think we're all there, because a threshold experience can be any seminal moment in our lives that has ramifications for years to come. Let's look at another example in David's life. In 1 Samuel 24, David is perhaps an easy one to point to because he had so many of these. So many times when he made a decision that very easily went one way or the other, because David was never in the gray area. He was either completely on board or he was off the track. And yet even when he was off the track, God could work with him, which was why God called him a friend. But I mean, if he was in for a penny, he was in for a pound. There was no hesitation there. But David had some insight. And there were times when he rose to the occasion. And 1 Samuel 24 is one of those occasions. If you remember the context, Saul is seeking to kill him. Saul has gotten to a point in his life where he sees David as a threat. God's spirit is being removed from Saul, and he's not thinking properly. And so as it says in verse 1 of Samuel 24, it happened when Saul returned from following the Philistines that it was told to him, saying, "Take note, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi." And Saul took 3,000 chosen men to chase down one guy and 100 or so of his followers. I mean, Saul was committed as well. But he goes out. Short story is, they don't find David right away, but they find this cave. And verse 3, Saul went in to relieve himself. David and his men happened to be in the same cave. You think God perhaps lined these things up, or maybe even Satan, to see what David would do? And so verse 4, the men of David said to him, "This is the day the Eternal said to you, 'Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as seems good to you.' And David arose and secretly cut off a corner." Now Saul had probably taken off his outer cloak, and David sneaked up and took his knife and cut a piece off. And afterwards, verse 5, David regretted it. His heart troubled him, it said, because he had cut Saul's robe. And so in verse 6, he says to his men, "The Eternal forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord." In other words, he's saying, "I'm not going to do this. This is not the right way to do this." So David restrained his servants with these words. He did not allow them to rise against Saul. Saul got up from the cave, and he went on his way. Now, how different would David's future had been if he had killed Saul there? If he had listened to his men and he'd followed through on that, how different would his life be? We have no way of knowing, do we? But I can guarantee you it would have been different. Because this is a seminal moment for David. He sees Saul not as an enemy, but as God's anointed. Now, if you want to write in your notes and look back at this later on, in 1 Samuel 16, you'll find that David was already anointed. He had already been anointed to be king of Israel. This is what his men are referring to. You're the king, you can do this. David says, no, that's not my right. We continue in verse 8 here in 1 Samuel 24. David arose after that, went out of the cave and called to Saul. And Saul turns and probably recognized, that's the cave I was just in. David says to him, my lord the king. And when Saul looked, David was bowing before him. It's not a defiant stance. Very respectful, even though Saul was seeking his life. And David said to Saul, verse 9, why do you listen to the words of men, the men who say, indeed, David seeks your harm. Look, this day your eyes have seen the Eternal delivered you into my hand in the cave. And someone urged me. He was being generous here, because I suspect most, if not all of his men, were goading him on this. Someone urged me to kill you, but my eye spared you, and I said, I will not stretch out my hand against the Lord, my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. Moreover, my father, you see the corner of your robe. If there was any doubt, he's showing him proof he could have done this. See the corner of your robe in my hand, for in that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, now and see that there is neither evil nor rebellion in my hand, and I have not sinned against you. Yet you hunt my life to take it. David chose the right course that day, but it could have gone either way, couldn't it? That was a threshold experience for David. Was it time and chance that David had this opportunity to kill Saul? I don't think so. I think God was waiting to see what he would do, perhaps allowing Satan to throw this in front of him to better see his character. In any case, it definitely was a threshold experience. To go back to my story, the fact that my truck broke down on the way to school 32 years ago did not in and of itself change my life. I wish that was the only time I'd ever had car trouble. What changed my life was what took place afterwards. After that kind man left me at the service station, I fished a coin out of my pocket and I called on the payphone to my mom, briefly explained the situation and asked if she could come pick me up. To which she said, no, I had a perfectly good thumb to hitch a ride home. No, she didn't say that. She said, yes, she would come get me, and she did. About a half an hour later, she showed up. And so I get in the car, we're riding home, and actually going back the same way I was going to school, and I see my truck there, wounded mortally on the side of the road. And so I'm kvetching to her about my truck and how expensive it would be to fix and how am I going to get to school and all of the problems that would create. She simply listened for a while, and then she asked a question. She said, had I considered that God might be trying to tell me something? I said, most certainly. God's telling me that I now have a 2,000-pound paperweight. I didn't want to hear that question. That's not what I wanted to hear at that time. I wanted her to console me. But she's challenging me here. She went on to ask me another question. Why hadn't I made a decision about whether or not I was going to be baptized? What does that have to do with my truck breaking down? At this point, in addition to being upset about my truck, I was really ticked off at my mom. And I didn't do that very often. Why would God, I'm thinking to myself, throw a rod in my truck engine to make me make a decision about baptism? I could say I'm embarrassed now at my response to my mom's question. Because if God is seeking to be a part of our lives, he'll use whatever it takes to get our attention. And at that point, God had my attention. Let's look at another example in Scripture. Genesis chapter 11. We have the example of Abram, as he was known at that time, before God had changed his name, as God began to work with him. And the decision that he needed to make as to whether he was going to follow God or not. Now, I have my own personal slant on this story. I think God was working with him before this, that he knew of God, that he had very direct information going back to Noah, perhaps even. But nonetheless, we're here in Genesis 11, and in verse 27, we break into the story here of Terah's descendants. This is Abram's father. This is the genealogy of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran begot Lot. So we know that Lot was Abraham's nephew. Verse 28, Haran died before his father Terah in the native land in Ur of the Chaldees. And then Abraham and Nahor, took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. The name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and the father of Iscah. But Sarai was barren, she had no children. And Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, the son of his son Abraham's wife, and they went out with him from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to the land of Canaan. They came to Haran and they dwelt there. And there Terah died. Now, we're introduced here, and there are a lot of interesting things happening behind the scene. Abraham assumes the responsibility of the patriarch role in the family, which is why he takes in Lot. But God begins to pull this family out of a culture he doesn't want them to be part of. And so if we continue, beginning of chapter 12, it says, "Now the Eternal said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, from your father's house, to a land that I will show you." Well, they had already started that process. But I think more importantly, what God is doing here is he's talking directly to Abram now as the patriarch. You need to lead this family. And you need to lead them in a specific way, he's telling them. "I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you and curse him who curses you, and in all the families of the earth shall you be blessed." So Abraham departed as the Eternal had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed. See, this is not just a young man's game. He's 75 years old. And he's picking everything up, packing it all up and moving. Why did God choose Abram at this time? Why this time? Why not earlier in his life? Why did he wait until they started the process of moving out of Ur? Maybe God was working with Terah a little bit as well. Why did Abram choose to respond? Why didn't he question it? We don't have that in the record, do we? He didn't say, "Well, wait a minute, let's talk about this. What is it that you really have specifically in mind? I mean, you got these great promises, but how do I know?" We don't have any of that conversation, do we? Maybe it took place, maybe it didn't. The Bible doesn't give us answers to those questions. A lot of the backstories, I would love to know a lot of the backstories. The whys. Why did they make those decisions? But God did call Abram, and Abram did respond. And it changed his life forever, didn't it? Not only his life, but all of his descendants as well. Changed history. If we continue in chapter 22, years down the road, an interesting part of the story happens. And this is where God requires of Abraham, he's now known, to sacrifice his heir, Isaac. Genesis 22 in verse 1, "It came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham, and he said to him, Abraham, and Abraham responded, 'Here I am.' And God said, 'Take now your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains in which I shall tell you.' And so Abram rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey, two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and he split wood for the burnt offering, and they rose, and they went to the place of which God told them." Again, why now? And what was going through Abraham's head? I bet he had every question that we would have. What is it that God wants from me? What if he actually allows Isaac to die? Is this really what he's going to do? If we continue the story in verse 9, "They came to the place of which God had told him, and Abraham built an altar," and he's still going through all the process, isn't he? He's probably, maybe he's taking his time, I don't know, slowly putting these rocks together to make this altar, sort of dragging it out. Maybe not. But he builds this altar, he places the wood in order, and he bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar. What did they talk about on this journey? What was Isaac's thought about all of this? I mean, he was the one that's going to have his throat slit. Did they talk about it? Did Abraham ponder perhaps that God was going to resurrect him? The curious thing is, though, Isaac's not resisting here. He's a young man. Abraham's close to 100 by this time. Isaac probably could have easily taken him out. But he lets his father do this. What was going through his head? This is as much a decision on Isaac's part as it was Abraham's as well. And so as he's about to kill Isaac in verse 10, Abraham stretched out his hand. He took the knife to slay his son, but the angel of the Eternal called him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham," and he said, "Here I am." And he was probably never so glad to hear his name in his whole life. And he said, "Don't lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." And of course, if you read the rest of the story, God provided a ram that was caught in the thicket. They sacrificed him and they went back home. I can guarantee you that was a threshold moment for Abraham. It changed his life forever, didn't it? God even said so. "Now I know." Let me share with you some of the other threshold experiences in my life, and maybe this will help you think about some of yours. Coming into God's church with my parents when I was 8 years old. That's a very interesting story to me. I wondered, because for about a year or so prior to all this, we were visiting every church my parents could find. Every Sunday, it was a different church. And I'm thinking, why are we doing this? They were searching at that point. There's even more to the story, because the reason they were searching was that my grandfather had been getting into Plain Truth magazine going back into the mid-50s. And my mom was stealing it from him when she'd go over to visit, taking it home. Later on, my mom purchased for me a summer program, art program at the YWCA for painting when I was 13. That gave me a vision that I could use my art talent for a career at some point in my life, which I did for 26 years. I followed up with that after high school, doing art school for 2 years, hence the truck story. Later, spending 4 years in Ambassador College, 2 years at Big Sandy, 2 years in Pasadena, and again, those events changed my life. Marrying my college sweetheart that I met in Big Sandy, May 17th was our 27th anniversary. Buying our first home, there's something about that first home, isn't it, that you recognize now that you're all grown up, well, at least physically. Being ordained as an elder, we've lived, Roxanne and I have, and Texas, California, we moved back to Ohio where I was from, then we moved to Rhode Island, now we've moved here. All of those moves impacted our lives. Becoming parents of twins, being hired as a pastor, all of those things. And as I mentioned, I'm sure everyone sitting in this hall today could come up here and have a similar listing in their lives of things that have changed where they are. Those are the interesting stories, aren't they? The whys and the whos, who they decide to marry, what they decide to study in school, what experiences they've had, what choices they've made. In Proverbs 29, verse 18, there's a great memory verse here. I like it better, actually, in the King James Version, but I'll read it to you first in the New King James. Proverbs 29, verse 18 simply says, Where there is no revelation, the people cast off restraint, but happy is he who keeps the law. The King James says, where there is no vision, the people perish. Without vision, people perish. The type of threshold experience we have, whether it's good or bad, whether it's a huge event or a series of small ones over the course of time, what impact that has greatly depends on our vision, doesn't it? Because even a bad decision can work out to the good. We see that going back to David's life. God still worked with him, didn't he? Still taught him. How focused are we, though, on God on a daily basis? Does that, if you will, overlay every decision that we make? Reread some of the great stories of the Bible and notice the choices made in those stories. The experiences. We'll briefly recount some of those here in a moment. but the experiences lived by the men and women in the Bible. I think that's one of the great parts of the Bible itself, is that God recorded real lives. They're not sugar-coated. It's not just the high points. God gives us enough of an insight that we can see them as real people facing the same things that you and I face, and being able to be encouraged and motivated, challenged by their decisions, that we can do the same thing. For instance, Noah listening to God building the ark. I mean, what did Noah think of that? What did he think of 100 years of being ridiculed? 100 years. That's hard enough to take that for a year or two, isn't it? What about Joshua taking God at his word and being one of only a couple of individuals that went from Egypt into the promised land, and watching for 40 years that choice play out in the lives of others? What about Ruth loving her family and the God she came to know so much that she walked away from everything else in her life? Did she know what impact that was going to have? The pivotal role she was going to play in mankind's history, not just in Israel's history. Let's look at a few more of those examples in Hebrews 11. This chapter is a great chapter of encouragement, because it recounts just a handful, but enough that we can get a glimpse of those who truly lived in faith, that through the good choices and the bad choices, lived before God with a desire to be part of His family. Let's just pick it up in verse 24 to pick a spot. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now, if you remember the general outline of Moses' life, he was 40 years old when he made this choice. He walked away from probably being Pharaoh at some point. If not that, probably being one of the wealthiest men in the world at the least. He could have had or done anything that he'd wanted in his life. He walked away from it all, as it says in verse 25, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. He at least understood that much of it. But that's huge, isn't it? Verse 28, by faith he kept Passover, the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. Now, he'd never been through this before. Can you imagine how odd that sounded, that God says, go home, make sure that all of Israel puts this blood of this lamb all around the doorposts of your house, and don't leave until the morning. I've often wondered how many people challenged that instruction. And yet they did it. And you know, the interesting thing is, we do the same thing. God says, this is the way to worship me. I want you to set aside 1 and 7 and come before me on the Sabbath. And when these holy days roll around, I want you to come before me. And we do that. And that seems so strange to the world around us, doesn't it? Ask any of your family members. They think it's really odd, don't they? As long as we've been doing this, they still think we're odd. We follow these same things. We make those same choices, and we build up those same experiences to change our lives. Verse 30, by faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days. What do you think went through their heads as they were doing that? See, I see these things as humorous. You know, that they say, okay, guys, here's what we're going to do. We're going to walk around the city, and we'll blow a trumpet, and then we're done for the day. But don't say anything. We're going to do it all silently. We're going to do that for 6 days. And then on the seventh, we'll do it slightly different. We're going to blow them really hard, and all the walls will come down. You can just hear the snickers go through all the group. What's he on? And yet they did it, and it happened just as God said. And it wasn't just Israel. Verse 31, by faith, the harlot Rahab, somebody that had no connection, no history, no background with the God of Israel, but she heard the reports. And I wonder how much she quizzed those spies that stayed in her house for a short time. She had enough information that she saw something better than the life she had. that did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace. And what more shall I say? But think of these examples. For the time would fail to tell me of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, the choices they made in their lives and how much different it made that life. To the point where you and I read those stories now, don't we? I remember those stories from the Bible storybooks my mom would read me and my brothers when we were younger. Who, through faith, verse 33, subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. And that's the whole point of these choices and considering them. That we're considering something better. We're making a choice that we can have a better life. Verse 36, still others had trials of mockings and scourging, yes, of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented. And we all signed up for this. It's a choice we made, wasn't it, at baptism, that we promised before God that we would forsake everything in this life if that's what it took. Notice verse 38. This is from God's perspective, of whom the world was not worthy. Not worthy because we're not following the world. We're not playing those games. We're not making those short-sighted decisions. God asks us to make decisions for eternity. Threshold experiences can happen any day. What differentiated the day that David met up with Saul in that cave from any other day? Did David get up that day and said, "Today, my life is going to change"? He probably had no inkling that that day would be any different. What differentiated the day God asked Abraham to sacrifice Isaac from any other day? What differentiated the day my truck broke down from any other day? We don't know these things will come. But we have to have the mindset, the right mindset, so that when they do, we're making the right decisions. That those threshold experiences will add up to the right things in our lives. We can be encouraged by the experiences in our lives because we're part of God's elect. We're part of the first fruit, aren't we? We have a purpose in our lives. We can forget that. We can become so comfortable and so familiar with that that we forget that the rest of the world just is going through life. Most people don't have a purpose. And what goals they have are probably for this lifetime. Our whole life is a learning experience. And threshold experiences help to mold who we are. Let me leave you with a little bit more about that story of my truck. As my mom drove me home that day, I was pondering what she had said. We didn't talk much more that day. Frankly, I was too upset with her and upset about my truck breaking down. I knew it would be expensive. I called around. Sure enough, it was more than I could afford to fix my truck. And so I realized I'd have to fix it myself. I had enough money to buy the parts, and it would just take me time. I decided that I would do that. It helped that my parents had a second car I could use. My dad had the tools and the garage space. I just had to take my time and do it. But every day my truck sat in the garage was a reminder of that conversation until I got it running again. I mulled over what my mom had said to me, and as my indignation subsided, I knew she was right. I was old enough and I'd sat in church long enough to know what God expected of me. And so that following Passover, 1979, I was baptized, 19 years old. That's a threshold experience because everything else was different after that. The biggest threshold experience for each of us, I'm convinced, is the calling that God has given to each and every one of us to be part of His family now. We are His first fruits. And as such, it's not just our life, is it? Part of what we're to be doing is to also be showing the world around us that His way of life does work, and in fact is the only way of life that will lead to true life. To set that example, how are we doing? Are we the right example and the positive influence to those around us that perhaps one day they can make the same decision? As we gather tomorrow to worship before God on His Feast of Pentecost, let's consider the choices in life and the spiritual impact they will have. The choices we make individually, collectively, what impact will they have? Let's grow in our lives. Let's make the right choices and have the right threshold experiences so that someday we can be in a list perhaps like Hebrews 11 here, and we can be a source of encouragement to others that follow, that we can share those experiences as a first fruit, we can teach and lead others, and so that one day they too can be part of God's family.